and the Graduate School of St. Paul.
Mm.
And so he gave a philosophy lecture in Athens, and he began with general revelation, showing that God the Creator is real. And he
went
from
there. Isn't
that
so cool, by the way? That's so cool, because that's actually what it was. You're not you're not stretching the concept there. It was a straight up philosophy lecture.
Yep.
He gave a philosophy. Where do they give them?
It's the graduate. Yeah, exactly. It's as I call it, the Graduate School of Apostle Paul.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensees. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. This episode is special. It's a really good one. I have a really awesome guest with me, Dr. Owen Anderson. For the Parker's Pensees regulars, I mean, you guys are going to be stoked because he's back. I don't know how many times this is. It's a lot. We've covered all sorts of stuff. And today we're going to be talking about biblical philosophy, philosophy in the Great Commission. And for the Jits fans out there, we might be talking about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and philosophy as well. So we'll see where the conversation takes us. I'm really excited for it. No, not too much promotion today. Look, if you like the podcast, you want to see me continue doing this, you got to support your boy. You can support me on Patreon. That's the best way to do it. You can support for as little as $3 a month, all the way up to like 100. Everything helps. Everything keeps these lights on and feeds my dog, dog food. So please consider doing that. Without further ado, let's drag in Dr. Owen Anderson. Owen, man, thanks so much thanks for coming back, man. This is a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah. I always love conversations and the dialogues we get into.
Totally, man. I have no clue how many times you've been on.
Yeah, this is probably like 6 or 7. Yeah,
it's wild.
But the way we do it, it reminds me of rolling, because you don't know, you kind of start at one position and you don't know where it's going to go.
Right. I like that.
Could end up anywhere.
I love it. So that's the hard thing with like doing the introduction, because I'm like, I want to tell people what it's going to be about. But it's like, I don't know. We're going to find out. We'll see where it goes.
That's the great part, though, is you don't always know. And today you mentioned the Great Commission. I'm organizing a conference on February 17th and 18th at Arizona Christian University.
Okay.
About the Great Commission and how it affects our lives as Christians. And since I'm a philosopher, I'll be especially thinking about it in terms of how should that shape our thinking as philosophers.
Yeah.
If you want information about it, go to generalrevelation.org and you'll find the schedule and the YouTube channel link.
Is that all? That's all there in person. That's all up there already.
Yeah. Cool. Generalrevelation.org. And then you go there and there's a link for the conference and you'll see the YouTube channel where you can watch it live while it's happening.
Awesome. Yeah.
I'll link. That's just to say, I got the Great Commission on my mind.
Yeah.
And, we're told Matthew 28:18, go into all the world, make disciples of every nation, teaching them to obey, observe all things that have been commanded, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. All of that. What does that mean for philosophy, right? Not just evangelism, but philosophy. I think it gives us some really important guidelines for philosophy. Now, I'm an academic philosopher. I've been teaching at Arizona State University for 20 years, which is the largest research university in the country. And so I've been around secular philosophy. I've taught at religious schools also, been around religious philosophy.
Yeah.
And the common critique of philosophers is that we don't get anything done.
Right.
Have you heard of that before?
Yeah, I have. I was just listening back on my first episode with Mike Humer the other day, and that's one of the things that he brings up in his intro, where he says it's like this really, really common critique of philosophy that nothing's changed and you never get anything done.
Yeah. Yeah, you're kind of asking the same question. That was a critique of Socrates, that his head's in the clouds.
Yeah.
And so philosophers have answered that a couple ways. One is to redefine getting things done,
right?
Like redefine it so that what we do is getting things done.
Yeah.
But then there might be others who try to make philosophy look more like science, and show that philosophy can get things done by being kind of like science. I'm bringing that up just because I'm wondering, as philosophers and Christians, how has philosophy contributed to the Great Commission?
Hmm.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. Can I
I think
that's so good. I wanted to pause and dive in real deep on, yep. On just philosophy and what is it first. And then we could talk about the Great Commission, and then I think we can pull them together.
Absolutely.
In a really fruitful way. So like, I think I've heard you say this of yourself on Facebook before. Sometimes you'll make claims and it'll really like irk a certain school of philosophy. Like maybe like the analytics are like, yeah. Dude, how could you say that?
Me?
And yeah. Yeah, and you'll say
kind of
like
a provocateur,
right? But you'll say, "Hey, look, I've studied analytic philosophy and I've studied continental philosophy, but I think you've said that you consider yourself more of a classical philosopher. Is that right?"
Yeah, if I had to pick a name, that's what I'd say is classical philosophy, because I'm dealing with the classical questions that philosophers have asked,
mm-hmm.
and I think things like reason, logic, can be used to figure them out.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you
now? So, analytics might say, "Well, that's us also." So we have right. to say, "Well, what's the difference between analytic and classical?"
Yeah. Yeah. What is that difference? Is it the tools that they use? Is it the methods? Like you talked about.
I think just historically the difference.
Yeah.
Like the classical school is asking questions like, "Does God exist? What's our highest good? And mm-hmm. how do we know these things?" Whereas analytic philosophy comes out of Bertrand Russell and Frege working on developing a perfect language, a logical language.
Yeah.
And so analytic philosophers in the last 100 years tend to just be trying to clarify terms for a perfect language. But the ones I've worked with have all said, whoa, we don't deal with things like, does God exist? No one knows that.
Yeah.
So they tend to still be skeptics or atheists.
Yeah. How about like
a skeptical theism, right?
What's that?
That might be called what's called skeptical theists.
Oh, I don't know. I get skeptical.
So, I'm not saying there's many Christians who are analytic philosophers.
Yeah.
But they may take a position, either they become classical philosophers when they talk about God's existence, or they take the position that we really can't prove that. That's a matter of faith.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I think skeptical theism, that term refers to like, hey, there's two camps of like, one is, hey, why is there evil in the world? Well, it's inscrutable what reasons God could have because he's this different being. Or like the camp that I fall in more is or more like you'd have to be God in order to know the greater good that he has for allowing evil to exist.
Oh no, we'll have to have a whole show on that.
Yeah, that's right. I know that's
to help you know the greatest good.
So I'm with you on this. We have talked about this.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm with you. Yeah, the tools for looking at a particular instance of like gratuitous evil. You're like, look, mm-hmm. maybe I don't know why God allowed this to happen.
Yeah.
Specific
instance. Yeah,
right. So going back to philosophy, can you give us a characterization of maybe how you think of classical philosophy versus like continental? We talked about the analytics, but how about mm-hmm. what's the difference between continental philosophy and classical?
Well, it'd be similar. I mean, I think classical philosophy deals with the problem of meaning in life and purpose.
Okay.
But continental philosophy especially develops out of the world wars in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption basically start off by saying only matter exists. Mm-hmm. And the world wars in one way are like they're proof that there is no God. Because if there was a God, there'd be no such things. And since only matter exists, life is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And so how are we going to project meaning onto the world? So you get different views of how to do that. Camus says you do it by observing beauty. And Sartre might just say you kind of invent your own. Each person does that on their own.
Yeah.
So it's dealing with some assumptions, not necessarily just the question, what's the meaning of life, but the assumptions that we're just matter. They never.
Oh, that's actually pretty good. That's a helpful. It's baked into the theory more. That there is no meaning. So now how are we going to deal with it? Because obviously there's no overarching meta-narrative.
Well, think about Heidegger's book, Being and Time.
Yeah.
Basically, Heidegger is, he likes Taoist philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically starting off with the idea that there's only change.
Yeah.
There's nothing eternal. So being and time.
Yeah.
And given that assumption, how do we find meaning in life? Mm-hmm. But I would ask, why on earth would we start with that assumption?
Right. Not even bringing in like, hey, look, I'm from a Christian, a Christian perspective, just saying, like, from a philosophical perspective, why do we start with these loaded, presuppositions, like that there is nothing transcendent? Why that should be on the table still. We should answer that before just proceeding.
Yeah, for me, that's where philosophy really begins, is that critical examination of all assumptions.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking today, I just posted about this today, that there used to be something called college music.
I just saw that before we came on, and I had this really quick chain reaction of like, oh, Dave Matthews. And I was like, oh, wait, who's Dave Matthews today? There's no Dave Matthews today.
Yeah, there's no such thing. Yeah, but I was just thinking about like the idea of college music, which is you're challenging the system.
Yeah.
And you're saying to the system, prove it. Like, what's your proof? You want me to live a certain way? Why? Why should I do what you say?
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's anything like that anymore.
No, like one of the classics was like Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
And they just go on and on, like, F you, I'm not going to do what you tell me. And then fast forward to today, I think I saw someone make like mocking them for like really promoting the vaccine when it first came out and being
they did.
And
yeah.
I was just like, wait, this isn't Rage.
Now it'd be more like, yes, sir, I'll do what you tell me.
Right. Do do what the machine says.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting. So what I'm trying to capture in the idea of college music is just this, I'm not going to believe what you tell me if you don't have proof.
Mm.
Give me proof.
Yeah.
And I think that's really where philosophy begins, with that attitude. And that's, I think you see that in Socrates, if you have to hold up a particular person, that's the Socratic method. But I find myself, even in this kind of discussion with people who call them classical philosophers, and let me tell you what happens there. What happens there is they'll follow Thomas Aquinas in thinking that Aristotle is the philosopher.
Yeah.
And in natural theology, which is what I particularly study, here's the problem for that. The idea is that Aristotle got as close as any human can with natural reason to God.
Mm.
After what Aristotle said, you need the Bible. And I think that's just a complete misunderstanding of clear general revelation, that God clearly revealed himself to us in general revelation. We rejected it, which is why we need redemption in the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
So what Aristotle told us is that there's an unmoved mover, but also the material universe had no beginning.
Right.
And Aquinas says, you can't prove otherwise by reason. You'd have to have the Bible tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, no, wait a minute, guys. We don't want to say that. We can show the universe had a beginning by reason.
Yeah. How about like the classic one of that is like, we can know God from general revelation, but we can't know his nature such that he's triune. What do you make of that? Do you think you can...
Yeah.
No God.
Well,
triune.
God, in other words, you put quotes like, we know there's something.
Sure.
So I would say this. This is the definition of God I'm getting from the Westminster Shorter Catechism, question 4.
Mm-hmm.
God's a spirit, mm-hmm. so not material, conscious, infinite, eternal, and unchanging. Those are called the incommunicable attributes.
Mm-hmm.
In being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the full definition of God. I think you can get all of that from general revelation. Now, when you say the Trinity, you're saying the three persons of the Godhead, they're equally God.
Yeah.
So to know the Trinity, you'd have to know that definition I just gave you.
Mm.
The Holy Spirit is a spirit, infinite, eternal, et cetera. The Son is a spirit, infinite, eternal, et cetera. And the Father is. So to get to the particular persons of the Trinity, I do think you need redemptive revelation.
Okay.
But to get to the fact that once you get, to know that they're all God, you have to already know what God is before you come to the scripture.
Do you think in principle it's possible that the Trinity is revealed in general revelation?
There are some things in principle where you notice, especially this is the one I would lean toward, is that the highest unity is a unity of diversity.
Yeah. Amen.
And so I think the particulars, here's, I think, a Protestant truth, the Reformed truth begins this way. You only know God as he's revealed himself to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we speak of general revelation and special revelation. And so we wouldn't know God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit unless they revealed themselves to us. Now, how much of that's in general revelation? I think we're responsible general revelation specifically for unbelief about God, as they just define God, not for rejecting the Son who's revealed in Scripture.
Right.
But if you were to say, look, there's a number of pagan systems, including the Egyptians and Babylonians, that recognize this idea of diversity in the highest unity.
I think the Stoics had a type of Trinity as well. I forgot who, but yeah. Okay. That's really fascinating. Oh, shoot. I had another good one. I'll come back to it. But when I'm really intrigued by classical philosophy because for so long I was admiring the analytics and also beefing with them because because of their so many were materialists and stuff. But then I was like, look, I just want to be a philosopher. I would talk about people say, hey, what are you studying? I'm like, I'm studying philosophy, and they go, what do you think of Nietzsche? Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't really like.
Yeah, he's not analytic.
Know,
I don't know.
Ask me about Quine or someone. But yeah. But I figured the popular audience has a particular view of what it means to be a philosopher. That doesn't define everything that I want. But I want to at least match that. Like if you guys are reading it, if abstract thinkers, non-philosophers, but abstract thinkers think something about philosophy, I want to have something to say about it. And like you said, with the Great Commission, if I'm a Christian, I want to be able to have these conversations anyway. So let me go and read Nietzsche alongside of Timothy Williamson, you know?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think that's part of just what you just said. It encapsulates it perfectly. Mm. And that's one reason, you know, when I was undergraduate, I did degrees in philosophy, history, and religious studies. Mm. And my philosophy degree was heavily analytic.
Yeah.
But in religious studies, I got a lot of continental.
Okay.
Both through anthropologists and also psychologists. And then in history, I did intellectual history. And I think that allowed me to see an important truth, which is that there are fads. There's intellectual fads. Yeah. Intellectuals are just like everyone else.
Yeah.
So some people are doing keeping up with the Kardashians. The intellectuals have their own fads.
Right.
And they come and go. I don't want to attach myself to them because I realize, so-and-so is popular today. In a decade? No. What I'm looking at is lasting fruit. And I think that's one of the things that scripture teaches us is, well, you'll know them by their fruit.
Mm.
What fruit did Quine produce?
Mm.
And I mean both in philosophically and personally. How was his personal life? How was Bertrand Russell's personal life?
So that seems like a very classical philosopher type thing to ask because apparently, look, I'm not a historian of philosophy or anything, but apparently that was a much bigger part of philosophy going back was
character building.
Yeah, what kind of life did your teacher lead?
Absolutely.
And they would write biographies about the non-intellectual side, you know, non-intellectual or whatever, if it's not integrated, side of the teacher, because that was part of like their credibility.
Absolutely, because the idea is that the more you know the truth, the more virtuous you can be.
Yeah.
And so part of what the modern world has done is it's disconnected those two. Socrates kept them together, but the modern world disconnected those two. And so they say, yeah, look, Bertrand Russell, he's making all these advances in logic. Sure, his life's in a wreck, morally speaking.
Right.
But he's doing great in logic. Isn't that important? I'm thinking, no, I mean, great. I mean, good for him, I guess. But remember in the early world, early Genesis, who the people were who were doing all the inventing? Metallurgy, ranching, music.
Hmm.
These were all the sons of Cain.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
So I'm not saying those aren't important.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm not saying those aren't important developments, but at the same time, you could develop metallurgy and end up alienated from God, your creator.
Yeah. Yeah. A story that I recently came upon was, I believe it's Thales and the Olives. You're familiar with this one at all? Maybe it's apocryphal, and it could not be Thales.
Oh, the olive presses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
He like cornered the market cause someone said that philosophy is not practical or something like that, or you should be rich if this actually works. And I think, who knows if this story is true, right? But out of spite, he was like, I'm going to go corner the market on the olive presses. Cause in like 2 years there's going to be huge growth and I'm going to make a bunch of money. And it was like, that idea is fascinating to me too. Not that like a philosopher should be wealthy, but if you are sharpening your mind and thinking about reality and figuring things out, look, you should be working towards being a virtuous person, but perhaps also you could do like decent economics, like at least your own home could be in order, you know? And that's something that I've been thinking about too, of whether or
that's
not
really what the word economics means. Right. Oikos, your household.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like, is your own house in order?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it starts from like the house and moves out into the broader society. And so that's just something I'm thinking about where I'm like, I want to be a philosopher. That means I want to be philosophical in everything I do, including my finances and including like perhaps even the way I dress and carry myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you present
yourself?
Yeah.
It is, I guess we could do a whole talk on that. I worked with Robert George at Princeton for a year, and he always wears really nice 3-piece suit. He looks great. Yeah. He's got a personal tailor who makes it fit perfectly. And so he might think, you know, that's what it means to really present yourself. Well, I like the principle. I'm not sure that application follows for everybody. I can't hire a tailor myself. Right. And so my stuff looks a little more baggy when I wear it compared to him.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And so this is something one of my professors, Brandon Rickabaugh, I think through, because I like the I do like the wool look of a professor. Like if that helps someone listen to me, fine, do whatever. That's fine. Brandon's got like this like techno philosopher look, and it's completely different, but it totally makes sense because that's what he's working on too. And it's like, oh wow, that's really cool. Another
thing, I don't mind.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I interrupted you. Sorry.
Well, another thing was, I hope I'm not putting all his stuff out here. I don't think I am, but, he would tell students, you know, just call me Brandon. And then, JP Moreland was like, hey, look, if they want to call you doctor, this is part of their education, part of the, surrounding, part of the academic environment. You don't have to tell them to do that, but if they want to, then let them call you doctor, because they're paying a lot of money to come here and learn in a you know, in this setting. And that struck me where I'm like, okay, that's fascinating. I want to help you learn. And if this helps you take things more seriously, let's do it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, doctor, I tell the students a reference you might know, but my current students don't know it. I tell them I didn't go to 6 years of evil philosophy school to be called Mr. Anderson. You know the reference?
Yeah. Mr. Anderson.
All right, good. They don't know it anymore. Yeah. But,
that's sad.
But I think, I think there's something to that, but I also think that it's regionally true. Like, I don't think I should have to dress like an English or Scotsman in Phoenix, Arizona, when it's 110 out.
It looks, right? and it would look out of place. You'd look like you're performing or something. It would look odd.
Yeah, you'd be pouring sweat out, and it's like, so look, I mean, I'm in the desert, right? I'm thinking maybe we bring back togas. That's what they're for. It keeps you cool, man. Right?
Yeah. All right. So maybe we can jump back in. You know, we'll put a pin in there, but maybe we can come back to.
Well, let me mention something real quick. I think this will bridge it.
Sure.
Whitewashed tombs. Mm-hmm. You can tell me from your experience, and I'll tell you from my experience, but philosophers have a certain view of themselves, professional philosophers I'm speaking about here, certain view of themselves. And so earlier when I said I'm a provocateur, what I meant was one of the things I do is I kind of poke pretensions on purpose, because people take themselves really seriously.
Yeah.
And so if you poke it a little bit, and you'll just see them erupt, and it's like, wow, that response is way overboard from you should be able to calm down and not take yourself so seriously.
Yeah.
But their view of themselves doesn't match up with what they're giving. And I think that's part of what Jesus was getting at with the Pharisees. They claim to be a certain thing, but inside they're dead.
Mm.
So philosophers think of themselves as really smart, but at the end of the day, they can't even show simple things about God's existence.
Mm.
Maybe some of them get to something like an unmoved mover, but that's a far ways from what I just defined God as.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we match up the view of themselves with the reality? Mm-hmm. And especially when we start adding in not just true and false, but words that the Bible uses quite often, life and death.
Yeah.
Are professional philosophers helping you? You've spent a lot of time in professional philosophy circles. Are they helping you achieve life?
Mm-hmm.
Or have they drained that time away and really replaced it with not much?
Yeah. So I have kind of an odd experience here. Most of the philosophers I've engaged with have actually been like really cool. And maybe that's self-selection, because I only have people on if I kind of know their stuff and kind of know their work a little bit. But honestly, dude, the people I think of when you were describing that, a lot of times are theologians.
And that's probably the ones who blow up the most at me. Yep.
Yeah. It's really sad. And this,
I've had theologians like telling me I have to believe them because they wrote a book on it, and they have.
I know.
They're telling me I'm a doctor. I was thinking to myself, they must not know who I am. I'm a doctor too.
Yeah, like, it's really wild.
I don't bring that out in conversations. They're like, you have to believe me. I'm a doctor.
It makes no sense. Yeah, it's like, who cares? Like, especially when you go through the academic like circles and you see like, oh, some of these people are stupid smart, and some of them are just kind of going through the motions, and everyone's gonna achieve this thing of doctor, or I'm in the master's program. So it's like, okay, this guy really knows his stuff. This guy actually doesn't. They're both going to be masters. So if they just say, hey, I'm a master's student, like, what does that mean? So what? I need
you
to
talk. And that they can be mistake what smart is. Some guy who knows 8 languages,
sure.
8, 7 of them are dead. But he can't even tell you why we need redemption.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he'd view himself as I'm among the most intelligent people who ever lived. I mean, maybe in one sense, but I guess here's where it might come down to for what you and I can relate to. I know we'll talk a little bit later in the show about jujitsu.
Yeah.
But we both know that the belt only tells you so much.
Totally. 100%.
And different gyms might award belts at different rates. So at the end of the day, where you find out the truth is on the mat.
Yeah.
And I see the same thing with proof, right? The truth is in proof. And so you could have a brilliant philosopher who can tell you all about modal logic. And he's right. You know, everything he says is correct about modal logic. He's right about that stuff. Has he helped you any closer to eternal life?
Yeah.
That's what I want to know. Maybe, maybe not. That's what I'm trying to figure out. So I'm painting with a broad brush here because I'm not naming names. Sure. That's not my goal today. So you might be able to point out, no, this person and this person.
Yeah.
But I've been around APA. I've been around this stuff for a while.
Yeah.
And if I was to ask them, hey, what's eternal life? It wouldn't even register on their mind. They think this guy's a nut.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's a tough criterion because the really arrogant theologians I have in mind would be able to tell me that. And then if you push back on their theory, they would rage at you.
I was going to say yes, but I don't think so because this is where I actually, if you look at my Facebook, this is where I tend to get the most heated responses when I tell them they're wrong about the beatific vision.
Mm.
That basically when you ask them what's eternal life, they all become Greek mystics and they think Plato's allegory of the cave is the Christian life. And I start giving some counterexamples like, no, that's incorrect. And that's when you really see tempers start flaring.
Are these like traditional Catholics or?
No, there's a lot of Reformed guys who I think they want to become Dominican monks.
Okay.
So they're making Thomas Aquinas like
guy. Yeah.
It's interesting. Like the Reformed guys are all going after the Dominican life. Evangelicals have for a while been Jesuits, right?
Yeah.
Molinism and futurist eschatology and revelation. Those are both Jesuit views developed in the 1600s. Mm. So it's like, Protestants, do we not have our own stuff? But so yeah, they're reinventing this idea of the or reinvigorating this idea of the beatific vision, which is like this thing where you stare at being itself forever.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to match up with scripture at all. Like, and yeah,
I ask one question? It always gets them. Is it cognitive?
Oh yeah.
And it's been weird because I thought it's an easy question, but they get really mad at me for asking it. Cognitive means you have beliefs like God is eternal.
Yeah.
Or is it just a pure experience?
Oh, yeah,
and they want to say it's a pure experience, and that's just not what we see in Revelation. If you're praising God, you're using beliefs, you're saying something like God is holy, which is cognitive.
Well, isn't that odd that a lot of the theologians, look, I love theologians. I love you guys, but I also have beef with you and I know you pretty well. A lot of them will talk about being holistic. We are not brains on sticks. We are psychosomatic unity. And you're like, well, okay, that's just that's great. Yeah. You know, the Greek, that sounds like integrated, you know, interactive dualism. So I don't see why you're as if we don't have souls or something.
Yeah.
But, it's odd, when they'll talk about being a whole integrated person and then really just slash off the intellect, right? It used to be like it was all about intellect and we needed to open up our hearts and stuff like that and realize we're more than just a brain. And now it's kind of gone the opposite way where it's like, no, there's this non-cognitive, just you're participating in being. And you're like, well, are you becoming God? And they're like, no.
Yep. No, I've had them tell me we become God. And I said, what are you talking about? And they'll give me scriptures where it's like, be like God. Yes, you should be like God. But there's three incommunicable attributes and we never have them. We're never infinite, eternal, or unchanging.
Yeah. Okay. So you prompted this question. I forgot to write down, but I'm so excited now that you prompted it. So in this new view of the beatific vision, whether it's new or not, whatever, someone will debate, but it's not, insofar as it's not.
Let's say it's Plato's view. He got it from the Egyptians.
Yeah.
And the medievals taught it put it into Christianity.
Yeah. And I mean, that doesn't mean that it's wrong.
No, it doesn't mean it's false.
Yeah, right. You still have to like make the arguments and stuff.
Got
to
give a proof.
Right. Yep. So I was wondering about this, man. Do you think that there's going to be philosophy in the new heavens and the new earth when we have glorified risen bodies? Are we still going to be philosophizing? Or are we all going to have the same like, oh yeah, totally. Obviously we are, you know, dualists and stuff like that. Will there still be opportunity, you think, for philosophizing?
I think, I mean, depending on how you define it, yes. Yeah. Right. But I think we'll still be thinkers and critical thinkers. I mean, all the more, would it almost be like, you won't be able to avoid it? Just the opposite, right? Versus there won't even be any. Everyone will want to know these things.
But, okay. So there's this kind of like simplistic view from evangelical circles that when you go to heaven, because you never talk about new heavens, new earth, it's always about heaven, and maybe you're floating around, maybe you have angelings. But now we know in part, then we'll know in full.
And that's probably why we get this beatific vision pushback is because of the simplistic view. I go to heaven and play volleyball, cloud volleyball.
And God's not even really there. But they have this idea that like there's just this information download that's like, now I know in part, then I will know in full. And they, you know, not thinking about the context of that or who or what we're knowing in full. And so they think like, it might be kind of boring. Yeah, it might be kind of boring that like I'll know everything. So I wanted to push back on that, but also think like a big part of philosophizing is, hey, we have this question and here's a potential solution to it. And then another philosopher says, well, you've overlooked this, or even that question isn't formed right, blah, blah. But, you know, with like God there, like we can just ask Jesus, right? And Jesus, what do you think? Do we have a soul? And maybe he'll just straight up tell us. Would that like ruin that that question then?
Well, two things.
Yeah.
Respond to the download view. Well, we know everything because it's downloaded. Well, you can't know everything. You're never infinite. Well, so you can't ever know everything. Have more to think about.
What about everything that, that's interesting. What about, we're never going to know certain things about like what it's like to be God or something, right? There's creator creature distinction, but there's a set for finite beings to know. Could we know that whole set?
I think what we'll spend our time doing, and this is exactly how it's portrayed in Revelation, is peering into the works of God.
Okay.
That's the main thing against the beatific vision. We're not staring at something. We're looking at the works of God and for this reason, to know the glory of God.
Mm.
And that will be never ending. We'll never get to a point where we say, I've already looked into the works of God. God has done so much.
That's a good point.
That we'll never finish doing that and singing that song of Revelation, holy, holy, holy. So you'll be adding to that forever. Now, the other one you gave was testimony. Jesus told me.
Yeah.
But even then, you don't know it yet. You can just quote Jesus. You only know it when you can give the proof of why it's true.
Oh, so
asking Jesus doesn't really give you knowledge.
So I would maybe I have a different understanding, and you can correct me here. I would say I know equals MC squared. I know that. I can tell you that. But I don't like understand it because I can't explain it to you. So I would make like a decision.
Yeah, I'm using those two the same.
Okay.
That's one of the things I've had to correct in analytic philosophy, reformed epistemology is, no, that's not knowledge. This guy, Jones, doesn't know that the person who gets the raise has 10 coins in his pocket.
Okay. Do you think that, do you think you have to be certain? Are you like an infallibilist about knowledge?
Pretty close.
Okay.
I would maybe consider some possibilities where you're mistaken, but minimally this, you might give a proof that relies on statistics, but it's a sound statistical proof.
Okay. But
otherwise knowing means you don't just have a true opinion, but you can give an account of it in the Greek.
Okay. So all the externalists are pulling out their hair right now. They're like,
And I would just say redefining knowledge to equal, you know, things without proof doesn't actually give you knowledge, right? There's still something called knowledge.
Yeah.
You could call it blowledge, whatever you call it. That's what I want.
Well, so I want to chase this a little bit because partially because you
are. And here's how we bridge it, because we're coming up to the knowledge of God.
Yeah.
That's how.
Well, and you are a gadfly, and this is a different perspective than you'll get a lot, because it's not like there's just a ton of classical philosophers running around. And if there are, it's not like they're aware of the analytic stuff too. So you're kind of an odd duck here, which is fun.
Yeah.
Do you have a smaller set of things you know because of this like internalist criterion you have? Like, do you know that?
Yeah,
you're
okay with that.
Do you know that you're talking to me right now?
I do think I can show that.
Okay.
But I'm also okay with a smaller list. Like, I'm okay distinguishing between knowledge and common sense. And knowledge and intuition. I think those are all three different things. And a lot of what the reformed epistemologists want to call knowledge is really intuition.
Okay. Can you, okay. So you have this intuition and you can turn that into knowledge by maybe reflecting on it or being able to, being able to explain why it's true.
Yeah. It'd be something like, I'm appeared to beautifully. I've seen a sunset, but you got to put it into difficult to understand language to be a philosopher.
Yeah.
I'm appeared to beautifully.
That's right.
Therefore God exists.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of proof without a proof, because it's just my mind was made by God. This is where they critique the Vantillians for being circular.
Yeah.
Here's this is circle in Reformed epistemology. Same thing. My mind was made, so when I see beauty, I believe God in the right epistemic environment. Well, how would you know that? Because God made it that way.
Okay, so that's my biggest problem with externalism, is it just seems like, like you said, look, I don't know. I'm scared of using all the strong language because I still am trying to get into a PhD program sometimes.
Yeah, right. I can be the provocative one.
That's right.
Well, I mean, here's the reason why I can back up and be nuanced.
Yeah.
I'm fine. And I am that way most of the time. But in certain situations, the provoking your interlocutor is important because they don't see what they're taking for granted.
Right. And so with the externalism, like my friend Tyler McNabb, I love him. But I think he made me into an internalist. I asked him about Neo in the Matrix. And I said, once he wakes up out of the Matrix for the first time, in my head, I think that he's just totally jacked for any of his beliefs because he's been systematically deceived. Maybe not that he exists, you know, maybe that's fine. But at least that, like, now he's in base reality. Like, no way. And
yeah, you wake up, you'd be like, oh, this is I've always thought the same thing.
Yeah.
Maybe this is their backup program for when someone 100%. Starts to get a little too clever.
Why not? And why not 60,000 of those? Because how hard is it to program that just snap it in once he wakes up another level? And then why even think that the robots are, you know, the whole thing gets jacked up once you realize you've been systematically deceived. With that in mind, Tyler was like, hey, man, it doesn't really matter. It just matters whether he's in the good case or not. And I'm like, well, how does he know that? And the externalists say, well, you don't need to know that. I'm like, you absolutely need to know that, because then
and the only way to know it is with internalist knowledge.
That's what
externalist becomes an internalist when they try to defend externalism, or they end up in the circle I just showed you.
Yeah, they don't. My experience has been that they won't. They'll just say, like, you don't need to know that you're in the good case.
Know.
And I want to.
That's what I said. It's just
that's
just redefining knowledge. Yeah. Like, I know something that I don't really know.
I want to hedge because. I know some of these dudes will just eat my lunch, but I'm just saying, like, as I'm thinking about it, this is where I'm at.
Well, here, it's just like jiu-jitsu. There are certain basic principles.
Yeah.
And there's going to be guys who are stronger, faster, more athletic than you. But at the end of the day, circular reasoning doesn't give us knowledge.
Yeah.
And some guy might be able to take you out to lunch in other ways, but circular reasoning still doesn't give us knowledge.
Yeah.
So what the externalist is a skeptic about internalist knowledge. They've accepted skepticism, and then they've tried to find some other route to something I'd call intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And then they still have to deal with the problem. Well, what if your intuitions are mistaken?
Yeah.
And they often are. I mean, most of us have experienced that our intuitions have been wrong.
Yeah, that's another funny one that people like have different understandings of, where some people will say intuitions are like supposed to be necessary truths, and others are like, no, what? That's not how we use it at all. It's also tricky, man. Well, okay. So,
I think as long as you're doing this, as long as you're remembering that knowledge is propositional.
Oh, dude,
God is real.
That's
what we're talking about. If you change that, then you're talking about something else, and I'm willing to grant a lot of other stuff. Then fine. Yeah. We're not even talking about knowledge anymore, propositions, but as long as you're about propositions, you have to be able to show why you think it's true.
Well,
if you don't mean propositions. Fine.
Can you?
Then we're talking about something else.
Can you know how to ride a bike without knowing that proposition?
Yeah, but that's where the word knowledge is ambiguous. That's know how.
So, but that is a case of
when
knowledge.
I'm talking about knowledge right now. I'm talking about propositions.
Wait. I thought you said I thought you're making the claim that all knowledge is propositional knowledge.
That's the kind we're talking. Excuse me. That's the kind we're talking about right now. Yeah. So someone says, well, I can ride a bike, but I can't explain it. Yeah, right. You know how to do something, which is a different sort of thing.
But it's still knowledge,
we're using
right?
the word know. Well, I think we'd probably say there's knowledge by acquaintance.
Like of persons and
knowledge things. How. Yeah, person. Yeah. Knowing how, and then knowing that,
yep.
which is the third
That's
one
propositional.
We're talking about right now.
Yeah.
So, So I know you by acquaintance, and I can, knowing that, I can tell you things, tell people about things about you.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Just,
and I think
just
when it comes down to it, even knowing how probably does reduce to knowing that. It's just that it requires reflection.
Yeah. I've heard that one too.
But right now I'm saying I'm willing to grant.
Yeah.
There's multiple uses of the word no.
Cool.
Some of them aren't propositional. I'm talking about propositional gotcha. Knowledge requires justification.
Yeah. That's cool.
I mean, think about the Gator example. I saw through this freshman year 101 class, he's told by his boss that he'll get the raise. And yet knows from past experience he has 10 coins in his pocket. Testimony and memory aren't certain. Your boss changes his mind. There's a hole in your pocket and some of the coins fall out. You don't know that the guy with 10 coins in his pocket is going to get the raise. If my boss doesn't change his mind and there's no hole in my pocket,
well, couldn't you accidentally know, right? Oh, I guess you're saying no.
No, that's the whole point.
There's no such thing as accidental.
It's not an accidental opinion.
No such thing as
accidental. Socrates deals with that.
What about if you're driving through barn territory, fake barn territory? There's one good barn in the whole county. The rest are all, they've been blown over and they put up a facade, but you're sleeping in the back seat. You wake up and you just so happen to look at the one true barn and go, hey, that's a barn. I know that's a barn. Does it matter that there's other fake barns in that territory?
No, because I think what you'd say, if you're being careful, is you'd say, yeah, I saw a barn. I saw what appeared to be a barn.
What appeared, yeah, because then you can kind of...
Yeah, someone would say, well, have you ever been wrong about that? Oh, yeah, I have been. So I'll have to go back and double check, and we'll walk around it and touch it. My favorite was I'm on a beautiful English countryside. I prefer, honestly, the desert, but whatever. And I look out there, and there's a sheep in the field.
Yeah.
It's really a white rock.
Yeah.
But there's a sheep laying down behind it that I can't see.
I haven't heard the white rock. Usually I hear like a sheep dog, but this one's better.
Yeah. So I tell my friend, oh, there's a sheep in the field. And I'm right.
Yeah.
It's just not for the reason I think it is. And when you tell people that's what philosophers spend their time on, they say, all right.
Yeah. Well, so just going off that case, do you think that guy doesn't know that there's a sheep in the field?
Yeah, he doesn't. Because if you were to ask him, point out like the sheep, right? This thing right here. Yes. This thing right here is the sheep. It isn't, man. It's a white rock.
Yeah, you don't know that there's a sheep. That's too commonsensical, dude.
Well, that's the thing. Common sense, intuition, and knowledge are all different things. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's good. I'm just saying, like, so that answer is too reasonable. It's just too easy. It's so good. You just cut through everything.
Here's the other one. The present king of France is bald. Analytic philosophers spend time on that.
I love this one, dude.
The present king of France is bald.
Yeah. Or
the barber who only shaves those who don't shave
himself.
Oh,
these are so good. I love these.
They're fun. I call these are like how juniors break their teeth, cut their teeth, right?
Yeah.
You throw them some of this stuff, junior year of logic, and they have fun with it. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But you know what? At the end of the day, you're spiritually dead before God because you rejected him. How's philosophy going to help you with that?
Yeah. I mean, you could be like an elder at your church and still be a philosophical logician or something, mm-hmm. right? And work on that's so good.
Yep.
Okay. So thinking
so that goes to the Great Commission.
Yeah.
And here's how.
Yeah. Yeah.
We ought to know God, and I'm with that full definition, not just some vague shadow. We should know God as a spirit who's infinite, eternal, and unchanging, and being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. And we didn't, so we need redemption. Now that we're redeemed, we should teach this to the whole world. The goal is given to us in Isaiah 11:9 or Habakkuk 2:14, that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea.
Yeah.
So I think the Great Commission is really just another way of phrasing what's said there in Isaiah and Habakkuk. It's telling us how it happens. It doesn't just magically happen. You go into the world and you make disciples. And really, that's going back to the very first commandment that humans were given.
Mm-hmm.
Be fruitful and multiply, fill in the earth. And humans sometimes think that just means have lots of babies.
Yeah.
But you could fill the earth with unbelievers, unbelieving babies. What if you have lots of Cains?
Yeah, this can be drawn out by just thinking about colonizing Mars. And you're like, look, should we colonize Mars? It's like, well, it depends. Should we turn it into a penal colony with just our worst, horrible, you know, probably not, right? Like, it depends on what you mean. But
they used to send people to Australia, I know, and right? Now we'll send them to Mars.
Yeah. The Australians turned out okay.
I know. I was going to say, now everyone wants to go vacation
that's
there.
Right. I guess they had another, like, rich colony over there, too, that no one ever talks about.
We want to fill the Earth. And so there's a couple things going against evangelical philosophers on this one.
Yeah.
The first is they tend to be premill dispensationalists. So they don't believe the Great Commission will even be completed.
You think you've noticed that Christian philosophers as well?
Among the evangelicals,
that's
definitely.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I guess I never really talked to
them. I mean, that's just
that.
What Biola's faith statement is dispensationalist.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. That's true.
When I taught there and I had to sign a thing saying I'm post-mill.
Yeah. They let you still in the door?
They still let me in, yeah.
Nice.
Because I was teaching a class on natural law, so it wasn't okay. Like that came up.
That's something that Trinity just changed. Evangelical Free Church just said, like, yeah, you don't got to be pre-mill. But that was like one of their only things that they could agree on, which was pretty wild back in the day.
So they've got that going. The Great Commission is never fulfilled, or not by the church. Maybe it's fulfilled when Christ returns, but the church doesn't fulfill it, which is the post-millennial view, which says, yes, the church does do that.
Yeah. So
Christ rules
are you
from heaven at the right hand of God until his enemies are made his footstool, and then he returns.
Are you amillennial?
No, post-mill.
You're post-mill.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were just arguing against post-mill, dude.
No, I was saying that's where I wrote down that I'm post-mill.
Okay.
Dispensationalists. But the post-mill view is that the earth is filled with the knowledge of God through the work of the church. We do, in fact, disciple the nations.
Yeah.
The amillennial view says it kind of continues city of God and city of man next to each other until Christ returns.
That's how, that's where I'm at.
No, I need an eschatology of victory, man.
Well, it's still victory.
Let's do it.
It's still victory. It just doesn't have to be complete victory before he comes back.
Total. All of his enemies are made his footstool.
Yeah.
They're all submitted.
Yeah.
Chokeholds to the end.
That's good. Okay. Real quick, you said you talked about knowing God. And I know you have this culpable ignorance view that, like, everyone should know God. Should everyone know God? Should everyone know God propositionally, or is this everyone should know God by acquaintance, or both?
So that's what always comes up, is the problem of knowing. So we distinguish common sense, intuition. I would add in their tradition, which is testimony of other humans.
Sure.
And then knowledge, where you have a belief and you can show why it's true. And I mean that last one.
Well, don't you show that it's true through those other means, like through testimony, through for instance, God told me this, right? Like that's how do you know that's true? God told me. Like that's a case that could happen, right?
Yeah, and guess what happened? That was exactly how it went down in the garden.
Yeah, so that's
and
just
it didn't
like
stop
a...
there. So God told you that? Did he really? And why did he tell you that? Maybe he doesn't want you to be like him.
Yeah, I mean, you could
and,
doubt
and they
it,
didn't, they
but...
failed. They failed right there.
Yeah.
The first test in history was a philosophy test about our knowledge of God.
Yeah.
From general revelation, or you might say, well, no, it's special revelation because he told them, except for to respond to Satan, they needed to know general revelation because he questioned the testimony of God.
So what's the general revelation that they're using to?
You can't be God.
Oh, okay. So
if a talking snake comes along and tells you can know good and evil the way God
does,
reflecting
on possibilities, right? So like, that like is possibility the thing that's in general revelation that they're utilizing to
I don't even know if it's possibility. It's just God knows good and evil without a beginning eternally. I was created 5 hours ago. I can't ever become without beginning. That's like a little kid can know that. You have nieces or nephews?
Yeah.
Ask them if they're like three. They'll know that. Hey, if something had no beginning, can another thing that did have a beginning start to have no beginning?
Oh, well, yes. Start to have no beginning. Yeah.
So that's the essence of Lucifer's challenge in the garden is, hey, God, you could be just like him. And that's really been the central sin ever since, right?
What if you
putting yourself in the place
I want to get
God.
Sci-fi really quick. What if you
do it?
Let's say the apple does give you God's powers, except for so you're everlasting, but you're not eternal.
Yeah.
So I eat this apple.
Everlasting and eternal are different. So I think we're already everlasting.
Yeah. So if you have like a B theory of time, then like the past moment is actual too. So if you add these powers of time travel or whatever, you could go back in time and make yourself exist in every moment of time.
You'd be older, but you wouldn't go back and have no beginning. Like any time point you went to has something before it. Or even if you go back to the very first thing, you're the first thing that was made.
Yeah.
You still had a beginning.
What if
that's the Arian controversy. They would say Christ was the first thing made. And the Orthodox say, no, right. Not made, no beginning.
Yeah. If you, I don't know if if I'm just guessing about you, I would guess that you probably are a B theorist when it comes to time. Is that right?
Well, I think it's essentially the difference between eternal and temporal. So we were talking about Heidegger earlier.
Uh-huh.
And he thinks there's only temporal being.
Yeah.
And I'd say there's both. There's eternal being and there's temporal being. So I think both of those describe, A and B describe those two things.
Sure. So if I stepped out of time, would I no longer have a beginning?
Yeah, I don't think we can be eternal in that sense. Yeah. We're always changeable.
Okay.
See, I think the incommunicable attributes go together necessarily. Eternal, unchanging, and infinite.
Okay.
So you can't be unchanging, but temporal.
Yeah. This is good, man. This is, I'm so tempted to bring
It kind of illustrates a point, which is that if we get certain basic things in place, other problems get solved somewhat quickly. So you said about the sheep in the field, it's such common sense and it's like an easy response. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that the analytics has spent their time on the last 100 years should have been like that if we had other things in place.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's like...
That's how Milton in Paradise Lost, he's describing the demons in hell. And there's a group of them on a hill discussing the intricacies of free will and predestination.
Yeah.
So in hell, they're doing
Lewis has
they're
that
doing
too.
Philosophy.
Yeah, in the Great Divorce, they have a theology club in hell. Mm-hmm. that's so good.
Yeah. But they're not. But the whole point is they're not getting like they want to seem sophisticated. Yeah. They want to seem like they know all the arguments. Honestly, that really turns me off. I think it's again going back to jiu-jitsu. It's just like some guy bragging about how good he is.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe you are, but maybe you're not. I mean, let's look at it. Let's see.
Yeah. That's something in jiu-jitsu. It was hard for me at first because in wrestling, there is no belt system. You know, I grew up as a wrestler since I was in first grade, and it's keep what you kill. And you actually don't wear your medals around. Like no one can see.
Yeah.
It's just like, how good are you? And you don't really talk trash because you know, there's always someone who can.
There's going to be someone. You. Yep.
Yeah. And then in jiu-jitsu, it's this odd thing of, you know, you line up by belt. And actually, that's kind of cool. It's kind of like some respect there. So I've learned like, hey, look, this guy, maybe I can stomp him, but he's two belts higher than me. And I need to respect him for the time that he's put in as well. There's like an honor type thing going on.
And Henner changes just a little bit because he adds in an age and weight dimension to the belts. So if you've got like a 40-year-old purple belt rolling against a younger blue belt, the 40-year-old or reverse that, purple belt's younger, blue belt's older, and the older guy still has cred though, because man, he's 40, he's 50, he's rolling still with 20-year-olds.
Yeah, and if he's a blue belt,
what
that
I like
means
about
jiu-jitsu, he just started that when he was an older man already, which is epic.
Precisely, yeah. But there's the belts are few, right? What, five of them? Blue, purple, brown, black, so four. White, I guess, is the fifth. And so they're kind of legit when you get them.
Yeah.
Like you don't get to be a purple belt till you know you can handle all blue belts.
Yeah.
And so compared to some of the striking arts where it's like you'll meet an 8-year-old who's a black belt. I'm not going to name any of them.
Well, I know exactly the one you're talking about because people always tell me, oh, I was a black belt when I was six. I'm like, okay, that's I don't need to know anything about that then.
Yeah, right. So I like that about jiu-jitsu, but also the truth is like when I've rolled with black belts, you kind of think if you've never done it, you think, yeah, I mean, what does that even mean? How good is that? And then you roll with him like, wow, it's good.
Yeah.
Like, they know tiny little things to do that completely change the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny going back and forth because like, you know, in wrestling, I would be a black belt, you know, I was a Division I wrestler, like, but it's so fascinating to think about the respect element, which I really, really like. You want to, you know, hey, look, you put in all this time. But then also, like, if I do respect you, when we go, I don't have to be like a spaz, but I do need to give you, I can't take it easy on you because like doesn't respect you.
That's right? Disrespectful.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about the difference because I have a couple wrestlers in the class I teach and it takes a while because guard is like the bread and butter,
mm-hmm.
but being on your back in wrestling is anathema and that you've just lost. So it's interesting to see them have to make that switch. Like they do bring a lot of skills. So like they're ahead of the game for people compared to people who haven't wrestled, but then there's also some habits they just have to break.
Yeah. It also depends on the wrestler. If you're a mat wrestler, like that was my thing. It comes like all the mat stuff comes super easy, but a lot of times American wrestling's changing more and more to being more on your feet. And it's really sad. And that's like, that doesn't transfer over a ton because guys just pull guard and you're like, well, dang it. Yeah.
Yep.
I wanted to make this connect. So we got the Great Commission. We kind of jumped into some jiu-jitsu stuff.
The goal of that, I think that summarizes so much. It tells us what the goal of our work is, to fill the earth with an all of God.
Yeah. So how does philosophy do that? And then we can circle all the way back to jiu-jitsu and make this thing make sense. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We were talking about how do you know God? Is it by acquaintance?
Yeah.
And so people will normally use... They'll make like a distinction that you have head knowledge and you have heart knowledge.
Yeah, right.
And the people with head knowledge, I kind of know what that means. I understand that's kind of what I've been getting at today with academic people who can rattle off a lot of theology, but I would say they don't even have the right head knowledge rather than make a dichotomy between them.
Yeah.
I think that's what we find Jesus doing over and over. He's encountering Pharisees and they can recite the law. He doesn't say your problem is head knowledge. He says you don't even know the law.
Yeah.
You don't know the basics of a law. So I would double down on, no, the head knowledge guys, they actually don't know what they should. But then the other common analogy is you would never reduce knowing your wife to knowing propositions.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to settle for that. And so that's what this is like. And I 100% agree that this is a relationship. I'm okay saying that you have a relationship with God because that should blow your mind that you can have a relationship with an eternal, infinite, and changing being. Absolutely right. Yeah. However, if Valentine's Day comes around and you go and buy a card and you write in your card to your wife, because you're going to praise her for her excellencies, and you say, you're such a great wife. You do things really well. You cook stuff sometimes. Good work with your hair. And give it to her. You're in trouble.
Yeah.
You better know things about your wife and be able to extol them off the top of your head to everyone you meet.
And even if you focus,
that's how it should be with God.
Yeah. And if you focus all about the stuff that she does for you also, like that's another aspect.
Yeah, just generic
God,
stuff,
you know?
Hey, God's really good. Like he made that sunset the other night and he like keeps the planets in orbit. Great work, God.
This stuff is pretty epic though.
Yeah. Well, give us some details. That's what they're doing in Revelation. They're praising the works of God as they see them. That's what the Psalms, I mean, you'd have a hard time finding a Psalm that doesn't do that.
So how, I find that in philosophy, like some of the puzzles that maybe you don't like as much or you think you shouldn't spend as much time, like I always talk about inverted qualia, and that's because it just drives, it's so fascinating to me that we're the kind of, that God made us the kind of beings who can even think about this kind of stuff. And look, I don't know. It's not like I should skip church to be thinking about Skittles and whether my wife can see them the same color as me, but the implications that could have and why like that could be used as an argument against physicalism, right? Like that stuff blows my mind where I'm like, man, God didn't have, he could have made me like my dog. I didn't have to have this kind of reflection. That's so crazy.
Yeah, that should. But isn't that just what Psalm 8 or Psalm 19 is doing? Mm. Reflecting on how God made the world and his greatness?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying those things are wrong. I'm saying getting caught up in puzzles that don't... I mean, essentially, I'm comparing to the Pharisees.
Yeah.
You spend your time arguing how far can I walk on the Sabbath, and you don't even know the spirit of the law.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
That's a whitewashed tomb.
Man, I think that's so much more for theologians than the philosophers I've met, even like the secular philosophers. And maybe it's because it's a podcast, you know, who knows, but some of the, like, I'll reach out to like a world-class philosopher and they'll mess me back and they'll be like, oh yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. Thanks for reading my book. Yeah. And sometimes I'll do that with like a theologian and sometimes they'll be like I'm just nothing. Like, oh, you know, I have, I'm used to this stuff. And like, wait a second. In my book, it's like the world-class philosopher versus like some theologian, the evangelical theologian. But in the evangelical circles, they're like rock stars because they get quoted all the
time. That's what happens. Yeah, yeah. That's probably what happens.
Nobody's quoting like Chalmers, but everyone's quoting, you know, whoever. I want
precisely, yeah. Well, that I think that's exactly what it is the philosophy world's a bigger ocean.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of mediums or small to medium sized fish, so to speak. Yeah. Whereas the evangelical world, it tends to be hero worshiping anyway, totally. Right? It has hero pastors that it goes after.
And we have to quote them all every Sunday. Like a lot of the churches I've been in, it's like, if you don't quote this guy, then did you really, you know, come on, you could have.
Well, that's part of why one of the things I poke at is C.S. Lewis or Tolkien. I've liked both. I've been reading C.S. Lewis as I could read.
Yeah.
But the hero worship is what bothers me, where it's like, if Lewis said it, it's true. I don't even know why it's true. Yeah. He said it. And it's like, come on.
It is.
Even Lewis wouldn't want that.
It is gross. Okay. So one of the jokes I really don't like is when people will be like, yeah, this is like at the Wade Center in Wheaton. It's actually a cool place. They got a lot of Lewis's books and stuff. And it's cool because.
Yeah, I've been there. I've been right. I've sat at his desk. I got a picture.
Desk. It's sweet. And so I read his some of his marginalia, and you have to like bring it out, and they're old books, so there's all this special stuff you have to do. And it's cool because you can see what he thought. That's what I really like.
Yeah.
But some people will go and just like, oh, this is a book that Lewis touched. It's a relic, and they make this joke, oh, these are evangelical relics, and it actually makes me sick.
That's what it is.
Where I'm like, wait, no, this is gross. And
Westmont has the true wardrobe. Westmont and Wheaton, they argue who has the true wardrobe.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, come on, guys. Like, and it's, so, yeah. Or
yeah, it's kind of cool to be like, okay, this is the thing that prompted this idea. That's cool. But like wanting to touch it and like venerate it and stuff, it's just like, this is kind of gross.
It is weird. It's the same thing. Whenever I've been to Oxford for conferences a number of times, and I know if I tell an evangelical, I'm going to get the exact same question. Did you go to the bar where Tolkien and Lewis would? Yes, I went. Even before they asked it. Did you go to the? Yes,
I went there.
I've been there. There's a lot of other stuff in Oxford.
That's so good. Yeah, like you talk to someone else in a different, you know, not in that circle, and they're like, oh, I didn't, I wasn't aware of. There's a bar.
I remember quoting in a class with one of my analytic professors. He's like the world scholar for Carnap. And we were talking about something, and I quoted C.S. Lewis, and he was like, you must mean C.I. Lewis.
That's so good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love that. The Lewises. Oh, man, it's so good. So
you're saying philosophers and theologians. Yeah, philosophers might be somewhat humble.
Yeah.
That might be like a character trait. Some might not be. But I want to distinguish biblical humility from false humility, where you say, I don't know anything, and I know that, so I can be humble, versus I don't know things and I should have. I should be ashamed of myself and repent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about like the, so the Great Commission, making God known, especially even more so from a post-mill view, how can a philosopher engage, how can they use their work to help the Great Commission?
Yeah, I think the connecting verse is 2 Corinthians 10:5, demolishing all strongholds that raise himself up against the knowledge of God.
Yeah.
And we're already told by Paul that we're fighting a spiritual war. So this is not like marching politically and demolishing something physically. Ideas have been raised up against the knowledge of God. And one of the things I find most troubling among young Christians is, and even scholarly Christians I meet, is the kind of naivete about the unbelief or the other view. It's very common to find them saying everybody already knows God and they're acting against their knowledge. And that's what you have to do as a Christian, is get them to realize that. No, I mean, you just don't understand what's going on in the other person's mind then. They don't believe in God at all. And they have a system that you apparently don't even understand. So the first step is just become aware of the world's religions at a level, maybe I'd say from their perspective, not just read an evangelical book about them, but what do they think about their religions, right?
And
so maybe an English translator said Brahman and God are the same thing, but not really, not with the definition of God I gave.
And I part of this is just like, this guy says he believes X, and you're like, not really. And you're like, well, that's kind of rude. Like, what do you mean? Like, if he says he believes that, then
right.
You know what I mean?
He's, like, he lied to himself or something.
Yeah. So I think it does hinge on a particular reading of Romans 1 and whether or not you think, hey, look, this says they did know God, but they did exchange that for a lie.
Precisely, yeah. They didn't keep it.
Yeah. And so whether or not...
I read it as a historical verse. Right,
whether that's history
they, or... Adam and Eve knew God.
Right.
It was abandoned for idolatry. Not every individual person, especially once knowledge means to give an account. No, they don't. So then you get into some kind of weird thing where they do believe it, but they also don't believe it.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, you find out there's different views about ultimate reality. Can you prove your view of ultimate reality is true? What you call God?
Yeah. And when you say prove, I don't know if you mean like objectively to every single person or whether it's like, look, this proof is sound and you can reject them.
I mean prove. Yeah, I mean prove, not convince.
Yeah.
Convincing is really the work of the Holy Spirit in the terms of regeneration.
Yeah.
But your job is to present a sound argument. And so I've been using some examples from Scripture. I call it the School of Abraham and the Graduate School of St. Paul.
Mm.
And so he gave a philosophy lecture in Athens, and he began with general revelation, showing that God the Creator is real. And he
Isn't
went
that
from
so
there
cool,
to,
by the way? So cool, because that's actually what it was. You're not you're not stretching the concept there. It was a straight-up philosophy lecture.
Yep.
He gave where they give them?
As I call it, the Graduate School of Apostle Paul. As I train graduate students, I'm thinking, I'm trying to make them be able to do that. If they can't necessarily tell me if the present king of France is bald, okay. But can they show what Paul did in Athens? And then I go back to Abraham and say, look, how did Abraham know what he knew about God?
Mm-hmm.
He had some testimony. Let's say he has testimony. Let's say the biblical timelines are correct and his life overlapped with Shem. So he has Shem telling him things that happened, and Shem overlapped with Melchizedek, with Methuselah before the flood, and he overlapped with Adam. So you're not going back very far to get what happened in the garden. And so he has that testimony, but still that's just testimony. And by the time of Abraham, there's other religions being formed with their own claims to have testimony. Maybe he should believe one of those. So the testimony is not sufficient, and he already knows God before God speaks to him. So the only answer is Abraham understood general revelation.
Hmm.
And so the school of Abraham is you should be able to know those things also if you want to have the faith of Abraham.
Hmm. So you have rival testimony evidence from these other, you know, ancient Near Eastern type stuff, and they're reinterpreting the flood and all sorts of stuff. Marta comes in. So that means that this, you know, sacred testimony, let's call it, all the way back, that one isn't sufficient. But then there's different interpretations on general revelation, right? Like, does that not like counteract the sufficiency of general revelation in the same way that the testimony?
It would if you stuck there. But what you'd have to do is, you know, have a sound argument. I'm not suggesting that all of those are sound. I would say you could easily show the Babylonian system is unsound.
Okay.
And I think the Babylonian system is really the system we have with us today with popular religion, which is this.
How so? Yeah.
There is an original thing. Out of it came other spiritual beings that made this world.
Mm-hmm.
So the original God is distant. He's hidden. If he exists, it's hard to know him, and he may not care about us at all. But there's these other spiritual beings, and those are the ones that you can have interactions with.
Yeah.
And so, for example, you were talking about the professional philosophers being kind of humble. It made me remember this time I was at the APA, and I was in a room with the big – this is 15 years ago. So if I was to name them, you'd know them, the big names in philosophy of religion. And one of them had just written a book on the hiddenness of God, and they're talking about – you know, the big name this, big name that, talking about it. And I just asked a question, what if it's clear God exists and he's not hidden? Next, moved on. I mean, doesn't even register as a possibility. They just assume he's hidden. And I say, yeah, that's the Babylonian religion that starts there. And then the other systems, in a weird way, that even the materialists say that, because they generally have some kind of like being in the background that started stuff out.
Yeah.
But then we are the local forces like gravity and inertia, those are the things that control our lives. So the question is, for Abraham, can I know God? Can I have that relationship with God, my creator? Is he exist? Is he personal? So I can have a relationship. Does he care about me? And then add on top of that, I've sinned against him.
Mm-hmm.
Can he forgive me? Those are the kind of things you'd have to be able to show against the Babylonian system and the Egyptian system and the Greek system. Aristotle and Plato are, I would argue, just apologists for that other system.
I wonder what role like other people's evidence plays in your view of knowledge. So like I don't think that the philosophers of religion would be like, yeah, like they wouldn't want to sign on to the Babylonian view. What if they're saying,
But they all say he's hidden.
Well, so maybe not to even to them, but just there's someone who has this experience of God being hidden. And especially on your reading of Romans 1, like there are people who don't know God, though they ought to.
Yep.
Yeah. So then there's this like phenomena of God being hidden to a certain person.
Yeah.
It's not
subjectively.
Me.
In fact, yeah. That's the judgment of God. In Romans 1, it also says the wrath of God is poured out in giving them darkened minds.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would just be your answer to the problem of hiddenness, right? It's like, well, that's part of God's judgment.
Yeah. So when someone says, well, I don't see God, I would say, yeah, it doesn't surprise me, right?
Isn't that saying that God is hidden though?
Well, hidden, I guess it'd be like saying subjectively hidden versus objectively hidden.
Yeah.
Like me staring at the screen right now, my eyes work, and I'm saying there's no Parker here. He's gone. All I'm without excuse, right? Yeah. There's no excuse for that. Now, someone could say, no, I've been having a dark night of the soul. And I've been wrestling with this for a long time, and you seem to be discrediting my wrestling with it. And there are psalms about this, a number of psalms. Lord, where are you? Right. Why is it taking so long for you to do this? And you've had me on before to talk about my commentary on Job, because Job is asking that.
Yeah.
But again, how does God answer Job? He doesn't answer him. It's really cringy when I hear most Christians explain the answer, because it's basically like flexing and saying, who are you to question me? It's not what he does. He says, Job, did you know me the way you should have from creation? And he goes through natural theology, 77 questions about natural theology and the created order, at the end of which Job confesses, yeah, I didn't see you as I should have.
Isn't that still kind of a flex, though? He's like, look at this animal I made. Like,
well, I think it's bringing it back on Job, though. How could you have said, I did what's right and God, where are you, if you knew these things, Job? You didn't know what you should have. And Job is so ashamed of himself, he humbles himself and repents. It's not just sort of like, oh yeah, oops, I did it again.
Yeah. If there's, this is tough to do biblical counterfactuals or something, but if let's say Job had known all of those truths prior to Satan being, you know, set loose against him, do you think God would have like also done it again? Like if Job had all this knowledge,
well, the purpose
was that
of
the
it,
end goal, right? Yeah.
That kind of rotates us back to the beginning where you were saying, we're talking about skeptical theism. The purpose of this for Job was what is called sanctification.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Job didn't need sanctification, would God have sanctified him? Well, no, right. Doesn't need it.
Yeah.
But so Job had things about himself that he needed to see and he couldn't with any other way.
So like, yeah, like, this didn't happen to Enoch, right? Like Enoch was just like he just grabbed him.
Yeah. And well, so you know maybe, what though too? The other thing is God might work in different people's lives.
100%.
Different people might come to greater depth than others.
Or just the personality that God's made them with. Like I tell people this all the time because I like when people like roast me and stuff. I like laughing at myself. Yeah. It's actually if someone gets a good joke in on me, it's because they actually know me really well. So it's actually kind of love, you know, and I'm from the Midwest.
Yep, exactly.
That's how we
the same way.
Yeah. So God will like roast me and like put me in like, I'm the butt of the joke a lot of times. And it's hilarious. But if he did that to my wife, she's not feeling the same kind of love.
Well, that's what I find out because when I'm kind of provoking people, it's because I don't mind if you look back, cause I don't take myself too seriously.
Yeah.
Right. So then I'm like, hey, you probably don't take yourself seriously either. Like, no, I take myself really seriously. Don't joke with me.
Yeah. And they should just do jujitsu so that they feel more confidence. And then they're
well, that's
they're
where fine. You find out you can't take yourself seriously, right? Because you go out there and it's like,
100%. It makes everything way worse when you take yourself super seriously. That's why I don't even like people knowing that I wrestled, because it's like, oh, crap. Like, I don't need that. You know, let's just have fun.
Well, that's why I don't know if it was. I don't listen to really either of these guys, Jocko or Joe Rogan, but every now and then you'll see jujitsu quotes from them. One of them said, it might have been Joe Rogan, I think, that every man specifically should do jujitsu to be humbled. But you start before jiu-jitsu, you're like, oh yeah, I could take anybody. And then you realize, no, I can't take anybody at all.
Yeah, he talked about like the average dude who thinks that like I can handle myself if I got in a fight. And like you have no
There's a hilarious Onion. You know the Onion?
Yeah.
Look that up afterwards. The Onion, it's like a fake study about men's confidence in fighting.
Oh, nice.
It's hilarious, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think knowing God would require, I think the analogy of the wife is perfect. If you can't distinguish your wife from some person at the store, you're going to be in trouble when you get home, right? If your excuse was your wife says, hey, I saw you with this other girl. What were you doing? Oh, I thought that was you. I couldn't tell the difference. You're in big trouble, right? So if you can't tell me something about God that's not just the unmoved mover, you're in big trouble.
Yeah. Especially if you ought to have known, right? Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. If
it was a mail order bride and you went to pick her up from the airport and you never seen her before and you grabbed the wrong one, that's completely different. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I'm using this one because they'll say you need to have relational knowledge. Absolutely. You should be able to tell me unendingly about the glory of God. Mm. So back to kind of wrapping up the Great Commission. To do the Great Commission, it begins with knowing God. If you don't know God, you can't disciple them. And when you're discipling them, that's what you're starting in, is the knowledge of God. That's the first and greatest commandment, that you love God.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually loved God, you'd be able to tell us all kinds of things about God.
Yeah. And then it's 2 Corinthians 10:5, destroying arguments and lofty opinions.
All the pretensions that have raised up, and they've said there is no God. Okay, there's something like an unmoved mover, but he doesn't care about us and we don't know much about it. Or everything's God. You're God. I'm God. We're all God. I mean, these are the big views that have been out there.
Mm-hmm.
I had Christians, because they like Aquinas and Aristotle so much, telling me it doesn't matter if God created the world or it had no beginning, as long as he's forming it into what we see. Yeah. Those are big differences. God made the world, or he's co-eternal with the world.
Yeah. I just heard of that the other day, where it's like, no, he's eternally creating.
Yeah. Aquinas doesn't believe that.
Yeah.
Aquinas says that's false, but we only know that from the Bible.
Yeah.
Whereas Aristotle thought, that's the case. This isn't the stuff of matter has always existed.
Yeah. We talked about Job and his sanctification. God, Genesis 32, God wrestles with Jacob. Angel of the Lord, I think, is the first language. Yeah. And then it's like, no. And at the end, it's like, and he wrestled with God. And it's like, oh, snap, dude.
Angel of the Lord, who is that usually in the Old Testament?
Yeah. So
it's
pre-incarnate
Christ usually.
That's what I would say. Yes. I think any humanoid theophany is a pre-Christophany, because it's tough. I don't want to get into like eternal functional subordination, but it's fitting, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. But,
But
he picked, he could have said, hey, there's a tree. Let's see who gets there first. He could have raced him. They could have had like an arrow competition. Let's see who can hit that thing over there the best.
Yeah.
He wrestles with him. Why?
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
I think it's a fitting analogy for the struggle. But I also think it's got to be the case that he picked the sport Jacob knew.
Oh, man. So that's fascinating. Maybe Jacob was a really good wrestler.
I have to assume that that's like what they would do as a sport.
Well, it wouldn't be Esau, like... wouldn't he have lost? I mean, Esau was a big sons. Burly. Yeah.
I mean, what sport do you think he did? Chariot racing? There's no sports. That can't
yeah,
be.
And that's
people
not
do
true.
Stuff.
Everyone wrestles, right? Like every little kid, like,
yeah.
I want that last thing. I'm going to tackle you or whatever.
Yep. So I would think this was chosen. There is an imagery there of wrestling with sin or wrestling with something, but there's also the idea of something Jacob knew and they're wrestling. And so I think you and I kind of are attracted to the idea, because we'd say, this really is the sport.
That's right. Oh, well, that's fascinating. It seems like he's probably good at it, because he was so confident. He didn't know
that's
God,
the other thing.
But he was so confident that he's like, I'm not going to let you go until, like, if you didn't know what you're doing, you're not going to be like, you're not getting out of this. You'd be like, I hope I survive.
That's the thing. Like in jiu-jitsu, a white belt taps like that just from pressure. Like, I'm uncomfortable. Tap. Right.
Yeah.
Like one of the first lessons you learn is, you're going to be uncomfortable for the next 5 minutes. Don't tap just because of that.
Yeah. You can still breathe.
Yeah. He's not only can he last for hours. I think that's a famous, match between Helio Gracie and Kimura. We get the name of the move of the Kimura from him. I think it went three hours until he like dislocated or Kimura dislocated or broke Helio's shoulder.
Yeah, that one's funny because so like coming over from wrestling, I get a lot of other wrestlers who are like, we had that move in catch wrestling. It's just a double wrist lock. And so, and there's like all this beef that comes beyond it. But yeah, that made it super famous.
But I'm just thinking about the 3 hour idea, like a 5 minute roll. And you're like, oh, I got to give me breath. 3 hours. And here you have Jacob wrestling all night and his hip is dislocated.
I love that. And especially we were talking about a little bit earlier, but I, as a wrestler growing up, I'm like, look, Jacob wrestled with God, but now as a grappler, a submission wrestler, I'm like, no, this is submission grappling because he said, I'm not letting you go until you submit and give me the blessing. Yeah, give me your blessing. And then how did it end? He dislocates his hip. Like that's not a part of rest. That's part of jujitsu. Yeah. That's awesome.
But it also shows the power just by touching it.
Yeah.
So this one who he's wrestling with could have destroyed him immediately, right? Just out of socket. And yet he doesn't. He's wrestling together.
So I wanted to go back to it's a really helpful point that this is probably something that he was good at. Maybe if he was a really good sprinter, it would have been a long marathon run or something like that.
Yeah, Paul uses the example of sprinting. I mean, a runner. He could use that.
He should have used wrestling, yeah. I think that there is a theological significance too, because the whole nation is named Israel and like wrestles with God.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun because it's not like submit only. It's like, no, wrestle and strive. What is, is there anything unique about the Christian philosopher wrestling with God? Like, you got any insights for me here? Yeah.
No, I think that's a great image. And the more you know about wrestling from doing it, the more it comes to life for you because you know what that's like. You're another person. And it's just that kind of pure sport where you don't have anything. It's not getting a football. It's not getting to the end zone. It's just you and another will.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta work on that. So I think that's a really good image of what the philosopher does. I like that. I hadn't made that connection before.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Plato is named that because he was a wrestler.
I mean,
wrestling's common, but I think this puts it a whole new level because whatever Plato says, he never recognizes his culpability before God.
Mm-hmm.
And says, "Yeah, I'm a sinner who needs redemption." He never recognizes that. So Jacob did the true wrestling with God.
Yeah. Man, that's good. Dang, that's good, man. I have some Pensies listeners who are like, "Dude, I just want to hear Owen Anderson all the time." And there's some who are like, they get so triggered by what you say, especially like the pure analytics. This is going to be such a good episode for everyone.
You'll either be triggered or you'll be emailing Anderson.
That's right. I love that.
Well, the
man.
Thing is, like I said, the triggering is on purpose because we take ourselves too seriously. And if you get triggered about something, it's probably because you're assuming another thing and you don't want to have that come out. So let's just get all the assumptions out there and look at them.
Yeah. So real quick again, I'll put the link in the description, but can you give us a plug again for the Great Commission conference that you're putting?
Yeah, generalrevelation.org. And there you'll see our conference tab. You'll also see a courses tab because I have a number of online courses that you can take with me.
Okay.
And just like you, I have a Patreon account also. If people want to come on there, you get kind of special monthly meetings that I do on there. Nice. So yeah, generalrevelation.org or Dr. Owen Anderson on Patreon.
Who should go to the conference? Like obviously everyone should go, right? But who are you hoping? What type of people that are listening would be like, oh, this is for me to go?
Yeah, you know, we've got theologians, philosophers, historians, even communication professor. So the way we're aiming this is any Christian in the pew who wants to know more about it. It's not primarily a philosophy or theology conference. Those fields come in, but it's for everybody because the idea is that we can and should, we're responsible to do the Great Commission. We can fill the earth with the knowledge of God. Let's get off our backs and do it, right?
Yeah.
Let's get out there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, awesome, man. This is just another fascinating installment of the collab between Dr. Owen Anderson and myself.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, man, this was great. I
think a future one that, together. You know, you're both of those audiences you mentioned are looking forward to this one is that we're going to meet in person and we're going to roll.
Yeah, man.
And so
that'd be awesome.
Anybody who says I'm triggered will say, I can't wait for that, because I'll admit the outcome. The outcome is you'll submit me. I don't have any doubt about it. But it's just a question of, you know, how long will this thing last? And so that's what the other audience
will
be like,
night. Yeah. We're going to go all night until you, give me
this goes.
Until you give me your blessing. Yeah. Well, yeah. Awesome. All right.
And
folks,
I'll always have an out. I'll always be able to say, oh, wow, you submitted an old 45-year-old. Yeah, great for you.
Right. That's so good. All right, folks, that's going to have to do it for now. If you guys like this, hey, you know what? Leave me a like and a comment. Let me know if you were triggered. Put it in the comments. I want to hear from you. If you thought that was a great point, leave a comment. It helps with the algorithm, but also, like, I come back and check them. Dr. Anderson might come back and check them as well. So do that. Again, if you like it, support me on Patreon, support him on Patreon. You can find the links in the description. That's going to have to do it. This has been Parker's Pensies. As always, all glory to God.